So we are continuing this discussion.
The first two verses of the Isavasya Upanishad, which I quoted yesterday, one is, the first one is, Isavasya midam sarvam yat kinja jagatiyam jagat tena tektena punchidhaha ma dhudakkasi suthanam gurvanneva iha karmani jiji visheshatam samaha evam tuina nidhidosti na karmani pilena. So two verses. The central point was this. The first line says that the entire creation, the whole world, is pervaded by the divine spirit, God himself. God is omnipresent, all-pervading, and also God dwells within our hearts as the indweller, regulating, controlling the whole process of existence. Therefore, this world is not our property. It is not there for us to exploit and to make use of for our physical comforts, to make our material life more comfortable or enjoyable. Rather, we can live in this world, but at the same time, we can enjoy this world, enjoy life, not through pleasure, but through the means of renunciation. Renunciation doesn't imply giving up, running away, or being indifferent towards the realities of everyday existence. Rather, it only means giving a spiritual link, linking our everyday life to a higher transcendental spiritual ideal. The example that I gave yesterday, you know, a small little stream with very little water. Maybe there will be water only for about a month, the whole year. And then it will be dirty, filthy, dusty, full of bacteria and so on. But suppose that river is linked to an ocean. Then what happens? That river, that stream becomes a perennial flow of water. Like that, if our everyday activities, our thoughts, not only physical activities, our thought currents, whatever we do, whatever we think of doing, if everything is given a spiritual orientation, if it is linked to a higher transcendental spiritual ideal, then every action becomes an enjoyable action. Enjoyable in a very spiritual sense, not in the empirical sense. The enjoyment of yoga is a higher enjoyment. It's called blissfulness. So there's a great difference between blissfulness and satisfaction or enjoyment. Satisfaction or enjoyment in the empirical sense is only the absence of pain and pleasure, which remains only for some time. If you have a coin, just two sides, if there is one side that is visible, it only means you are not able to see the other side, which is facing the ground. What we see on the surface, we can see. It doesn't mean that it is not another side. Like that, in the empirical sense, every experience of happiness or joy is not really happiness. It is only the absence of unhappiness. And that absence of unhappiness is only a temporary existence, temporary experience. It won't be there for a time, because what gives us joy or pleasure is lost next day, and then its opposite, the absence of happiness or unhappiness, is the result. But once our life is linked to this transcendent spiritual ideal, then it becomes a complete, wholesome, blissful experience. Now the question arises, you know, I mentioned the first verse. There is one word which you read, ma grudha kasya siddhan. Don't aspire for things that belong to us. It's a literal meaning. And you should renounce. Renouncing what? Renouncing attachment. Renouncing desires. Renouncing emotional obsession with the results of what we do. Results of our actions. The question arises, in our everyday life, we cannot really do things without a desire, without a plan, without a purpose. It's our everyday experience. Even meditation, unless somebody tells you meditation helps you, maybe to improve your spiritual life, then you start meditation thinking that it is going to help us. So it is not humanly possible, psychologically it is not possible for us to undertake anything, any endeavor, without some connecting related purpose, motive, or some consequence, which we should be expecting, should be positive and helpful in our life. This is the psychological fact. So our scriptures are fully aware of this problem. There is a statement in the ancient tradition, you know, prayojanam anuddishya na mantovi pravartade. Mantha means moron. You call idiot in the psychological sense. IQ level is very low. Call me idiot or moron. Even a moron won't work without some purpose in his mind. Maybe very primitive, but some purpose will be there. That's the meaning of this statement. Now, here, the scriptures lay down a very important principle. It is not repression that is intended here. If we repress our purpose or desire, there's one great danger. You find in spiritual life, I come across some many devotees. You know, sometimes they take to spiritual life due to some tragic event, some unexpected, unbearable tragedy happened in their life. The loss of the near and dear ones, or anything like that. Immediately they take a turn to spiritual life. Now this is fine, in fact. In fact, if you read the lives of many of the ancient saints, many of them got a spiritual awakening in their life due to some setback which they could not bear. So it made a sudden turn in their life. There is also a danger in this. When, after some time, that difficult situation has passed, when you have forgotten that, then you may also become indifferent to spiritual life. So spiritual life should not be a solution to a material problem. Empirical tragedy or unpleasant experience may indirectly become a cause for our turning to spiritual life. But once we turn to spiritual life, we must keep it alive through discussion, through prayer, through scriptural reading, listening to spiritual ideas. So this negative running away from a problem should become a positive approach movement towards spirituality. So there is an intermediate process here. I can explain once more. What happens, you know, in many cases, we work hard and we have a definite purpose. We are so much obsessed, so much focused on what we are doing, giving everything we have got to achieve a positive result. Nothing left out, no pain spared, but still the result is opposite. So naturally, we confront the idea that our actions do not always produce the expected result. That is a contradiction to law of physics and mathematics. In mathematics, 2 plus 2 is always 4. You can't get anything else if you put 2 plus 2 together. There's no way out. So also in physics or chemistry. Make chemicals put together in identical conditions, in identical manner, will have identical results. But not in life. In life, there is always an unknown, unpredictable element. It is this unpredictable element that really makes us turn to poetry, mysticism, drawing, many such higher pursuits. Some of the greatest masters of art, literature, mysticism, they face with this problem. See, in life, If we work, in mathematics and physics and chemistry, in material world, if we put elements together, they will have a completely predictable, determinable, expected result. No difference. 2 + 2 = 4. But in life, it doesn't happen. You put your best effort, work hard, with all concentration, with a very high level of professionalism and efficiency. And then you may get a result, but the result of the result will be unpleasant. You know, result of the result. Lot of money we may make as a result of hard work. But that money doesn't bring happiness, because we expect that money will have the result defect of bringing happiness. Otherwise, nobody will try to make money for getting misery. Nobody will do that. We may know every day, in fact, you need not be a philosopher to realize the fact that material comforts do not always bring eternal happiness or joy. We may read books. Any book you read, even if you are a well-educated man, in a purely secular sense, you will understand that life is full of unknowns and unpredictables. But then in actual practice, we forget it for a minute and go all out to accumulate things, means that we expect will bring us eternal joy, which we know intellectually is not going to happen. So here we are faced with this problem. I mean, 2 + 2 = 4 in mathematics, but in life, 2 + 2 may be 5, 6 or anything, or maybe 0. It may be 0 even. What does it mean? There is always an unknown, unpredictable, unimaginable, unexpected that we may land in as a result of all our actions. Then we take the spiritual. Those who are highly evolved tell the spiritual life, start meditation. Those who are not so well evolved may take to Aristotle or Plato. Those who are still less evolved may take to literature or poetry. Those who are not at all evolved may take to alcoholism or drugs. There are several layers of attempts to sublimate or run away from. Anyway, not sublimation. It is only flight from non-pleasant reality. Now, Vedanta says, no, this is not going to work. Vedanta says, you may turn to spiritual life when you are caught by your throat by an unpleasant destiny, forced and compelled to turn to spiritual life. But then, once you turn to spiritual life, we must keep it alive, like little flavor should be kept alive by adding more and more fuel, by reading scriptures, by thinking of the changeable nature of all these empirical pleasures and enjoyments. And then you know what happens? Then from a negative running away from an unpleasant reality of material life, it becomes a positive evolution, positive pursuit of the higher spiritual. Now, in this process, Vedanta makes an interesting point. That means some other commentators, make it a point, it's not repression, but it is sublimation. Desires and emotions and feelings and expectations can be sublimated. So sublimation is a positive evolution. Sublimation is growth. Sublimation helps you to transcend. Repression is only postponement of the problem. The problems will return with multiple, with compound interests. You have to pay the price for it. Repression is not only postponement, it's an invitation to greater problems. So, in this context, there is a very famous statement, not in the Gita or in the Isavasya Upanishad, But in another scripture, Narada Bhakti Sutta, Narada's great dictum, his great pithy statement, it's called Sutra. So, it says, Tadarpida Akhilachara San Kama Krodhadi Abhimanadikam Tasmineva Karaniyam. He means, that means what? All our actions, kama means desire, emotions, our great ambitions, and our anger. Krodha means anger, frustration, and ego. Abhimanadika means ego, pride. All this tasmin neva, here means tasmin means Ishwareva, means in God. Now turn them towards God. Now, what happens, you know, if it is done sincerely, then even a stone that you throw at God becomes a flower when it reaches you. But if you do it with arrogance, then even a flower becomes a stone. That is an important principle in, it's called Devada Puja Mantra. I mean, Shankaracharya has written a very famous book. In fact, it was Shankaracharya who actually formulated all the patterns of Hindu puja traditions that we follow, not only in this country but all over Indian temples. He was the one, the greatest Advaita non-dualistic philosopher, was also the exponent and the formulator of the most elaborate dualistic rituals. So he makes a statement: if we offer to God even a stone, you have nothing else in your hand. Suppose you are a stone cutter, you have nothing else. And this temple or church or whatever may be going on, you don't have money to donate. Suppose stone cutter supplies some 10 stones, that is also a great offering. If you have a flower garden, you offer 5 flowers. So whatever we have, we offer to God with great concentration and focus. It's called technically the word Sardha. Then you know what happens? A result will be multifold, thousandfold. If done with devotion, with concentration and a genuine feeling. On the other hand, even if you pay $1 billion donation for a great spiritual cause with arrogance, then that becomes a stone. So, what happens here? Even your anger can be oriented towards God. Ambitions and desires can be oriented towards God. Even ego can be oriented towards God. In the, there's an interesting incident, it's not a story, legend. It's an incident. It so happened that one disciple of a great monk who had taken initiation, who had started practicing meditation, japa, things like that, was facing a great problem in the form of a temptation of a questionable character. Of a maybe woman or something. So it was reported to this great monk. I mean, this person who was trying to be a monk was facing a great temptation. It could lead to a fall if he doesn't have grace of God. So what that great monk heard about it, you know what he did? He sent to this man, his disciple, the photo of a film star. Now what happened? This person has a great devotion, respect for the teacher. So whenever he saw this photo, he did not remember the film star, he remembered the guru who had sent this photo. So what happens? A most unpleasant emotion that then became a great obstacle in his spiritual life became an instrument that made his devotion more and more solid, and he became a great saint eventually. So you can find here, Narada says, Tadarpida Akhilachara, all our actions, Vishvarpida means offered, dedicated to God. Even kama, krodhadi, abhimanadikam, ego, sense of pride, sense of confidence, desire, anger, all can be given a Godward orientation, a spiritual orientation. So we should remember that ego is not altogether a bad thing. Ego manifesting as self-confidence and determination can help us in spiritual life. The same ego can become arrogance that can bring a downfall in spiritual life. You find in Swami Vivekananda's life, he was not proud in that sense, but he was a young man of strong self-confidence. He was not willing to believe whatever he was told. But it was not intellectual arrogance. Because intellectual arrogance is like a cycle. You go on rotating, you never come out of it. So we sometimes ask questions without really bothering about what questions we are asking. So we also want to take seriously what answers we are getting. Again, we may ask the same question again. So that means we never come out of this veil of skepticism. So intellectual arrogance keeps us bound to the veil. But the same intellectual arrogance manifesting as positive self-confidence helps us to come out of this veil, skepticism. So Vivekananda was perhaps the most outspoken among the young men who assembled in Sri Ramakrishna's room when he was leading the Dakshinakshya. And Sri Ramakrishna actually appreciated his self-confidence and his rational thinking and his unwillingness to accept anything without question. He was rather a great admirer of Vivekananda's outspoken nature. But because he was so outspoken, what happened? When Sri Ramakrishna actually showed him and explained to him, he was fully convinced. So that's why in the Gita, in the Bhakti Yoga, the 12th chapter, Lord Krishna gives a list of the characteristics of great devotee, an ideal devotee of God, a spiritual seeker, so to speak. So, Santushta Sadadam Yogi Yatatma Dhridanischaya. The last word in this line, Dhridanischaya means a person, a spiritual seeker with a strong determination, a steely heart. The strong determination is the hallmark of a spiritual seeker. Why? If you read the teachings of St. Teresa of Avila, or often I quote, one of the books that I frequently quote is The Way of a Pilgrim, because it's a very small book which anyone can read, The Way of a Pilgrim and the Pilgrim Continues His Journey. A Russian mystic who was a peasant, barely literate, one day he went to a church where he listened to the St. Paul's first episode, in which St. Paul mentions the importance of unceasing prayer, which in Narada's system is called ajapa-japa, means you always continuously and spontaneously, effortlessly repeat the name of God. So this is mentioned in his own language by St. Paul in his first episode. So this Russian person living very close to Siberia in a very backward region, he happened to hear this. There were many listening to the preacher, the Russian Orthodox Church clergyman, expounding St. Paul. But then this man, who was barely literate, a very peasant, a rustic, he heard, immediately he went deep into his mental system. So he wanted to learn the art of unceasing prayer. He didn't stop there. He left his home with an old bag full only with some dry bread, nothing else. So he wanted to go in search of somebody who teaches him the art of unceasing prayer. And eventually, of course, he met a Russian Orthodox monk who took him into his private cell where he instructed this peasant in the art of unceasing prayer. And when he learned it, he felt a great blissfulness. You can read it in The Way of a Pilgrim by Mr. French Translator. French is the name of the translator, not the Frenchman. Translated into English by R.M. French. So, the point is, what I want to drive home is, this man wanted to go all the way to Jerusalem. First to Odessa and then crossing the waters to Jerusalem. That was his strong determination. He didn't go there, of course, because before he reached there, he got a teacher who taught him. The point is, what all troubles and difficulties he had to encounter. So here you find an emotion that might have manifested as arrogance manifests as a strong, steely determination, which turns a person into a great saint. His autobiography was found in Mount Athos and was translated into several languages. He didn't intend that book to be published. There is an identical story in the Bhagavata Purana. It's called Dhruva Vakhyana. It's the fifth, sixth, and seventh, eighth, ninth, twelfth, and twelfth chapter. Total five chapters in the Bhagavata Purana. It deals with the Dhruva story. I won't go into details. Only this much I would say. Dhruva was the name of a little boy who was the son of a king. He was ill-treated by his stepmother and eventually by his father also. So he leaves his palace with a boy of 5 years. And his mother told him, see, all this happened because of your previous life. Some unpleasant deeds you might have done. But you need not worry. You can have a solution to this problem. You meditate on God, Vishnu, and through spiritual practice, you can solve any problem, including a simple domestic problem. A little boy, he was not a spiritual seeker in the conventional sense of that term. He felt he was insulted when he was not treated with affection by his father. And he was, in a way, rejected or not properly treated by his stepmother. And his mother was in a helpless condition, who blessed him and sent him to the forest. And he was walking through the forest. This story. Little boy of 5 years. Now, when Dhruva was walking, there is a great saint, you know, the same Narada, who wrote this spiritual literature, which I quoted from. He saw this little boy walking in the distance. In the forest. So he wanted to test whether this boy is really aware of the problems that a spiritual seeker has to confront. So he slowly approached him, asked him, what's the matter? The little boy told him, you know, I'm the son of Uttanapada, the great king, but I was not treated properly. My father did not show any affection to me. So I left my palace with my mother's blessings and now I am going in search of God. I want to sit somewhere and meditate. I don't know how to meditate. I don't know how to pray to God. So Narada was a very intelligent person. He was a great sage. He wanted to help the boy. But he wanted to make sure that the boy really deserved to be helped. So he tried to dissuade the boy, discourage him. See, you are a little boy of 5 years. You should be playing in a palace with your friends. And you are walking in this dense forest full of wild animals. Maybe it is something very risky and dangerous. So you should go back to your palace. Then Dhruva said, well, you know, if I go to my home, again have these problems, my father will scold me, stepmother will ill-treat me, things like that. Narada told him, well, don't worry. I have prayed to God. From now onwards, they will show all affection to you. So don't worry, go back. You can go and play with your friends. Then boy said, no, I have started my journey on a spiritual goal. So I won't turn back till I have reached my goal. Then Narada exclaimed, Aho teja kshatriyama, is a great statement in Bhagavad Gita. So what is the determination, the steely heart of a kshatriya, of a prince? So Dhruva went back. Dhruva did not go back. Dhruva got instruction from Narada on how to meditate, how to do prayer, and eventually in 6 months he had a realization. And when he went back, he was received with great honor by his father, his stepmother, everyone. Now the whole story is this. The little boy did not turn back. That steely determination plus sublimation of desires. These are two means for us to graduate from karma into karma yoga. Because when you take to karma yoga, immediately this problem will arise. Anybody who listens to a talk on actions without desire, action without attachment, offering the results of our action to God, such ideas will immediately pose these challenges. How can I do anything without a purpose, without a plan, without a scheme, without some preparations? Preparation means we are planning for the result. So, the great teacher says, it is fine. Even your plan, even your expectations, your emotions and desires, keep them intact, but process them, refine them by giving them a spiritual orientation. So that's why Narada says tadarpana. Tadarpana means offering to God. Tadarpita hilachara. So whatever you do, all your actions becomes arpita, means offered to God. Including desire, kama, krodhadi, abhimanadika. Then karma yoga becomes easy. Because one problem is, if you deliberately try to practice non-attachment on a fine morning, the first problem that will arise is this. Your mind goes void. Your mind becomes a vacuum. I don't have a purpose. So what to do? So Lord Krishna himself says, Na buddhi vedam janiye ajnanam karma sankinam. It's a great psychology. He says, never tell anyone to start practicing karma yoga all of a sudden on a fine morning. Because first of all, well, suddenly tomorrow onwards I shall do everything without desire. Without understanding the psychological implications, if we remove from our mind all expectations and plans and ideas, preparations, what happens, you know? Suddenly the mind goes void. There's a blankness in the mind, a darkness. And then gradually you'll find this is not practical. Then, you know, we go back to the other extreme. So, Lord Krishna says, and also Narada says, give a Godward orientation. Why you should be given a spiritual orientation? Now, these desires are compared to a burning flame, burning fire. So, a statement in Manu, Na trutti prayalabhe asti trishnana adviprashamide samprajyulati sambhuya samidvireva pavaka. The meaning is this. Suppose you have a lot of desire. You say, well, I shall work hard for the first 10 years to fulfill all my desires. And then I have no more desire. It's not going to happen. Because what happens, you know, you have got a blazing fire in front of you and you are pouring ghee or oil, thinking that you can put out the fire. Oil or ghee correspond to desire. So if we ever imagine that we will come to a stage we'll have no desire at all, it's not going to happen. So the first state is to give a spiritual orientation to our desires, emotions and feelings. In actual practice, what does it mean? Whatever we do, through mind or the five senses of action or five senses of perception, intellectually or physically, whatever we do, do it, but then keep in mind that this is my offering to God. So along with karma, the yoga element also comes into play. Then what happens, you know, every action becomes a spiritual practice. Every action can be turned into a spiritual practice. That's how it happens eventually. But to begin with, just give a spiritual orientation towards God. So this idea is expounded by a great king in the Mahabharata. It's not a very pleasant story, but you know, but still it shows an extreme example. There was a king, his name was Yayati. He was a very powerful, efficient man. He was very old also. But still he wanted to enjoy this world more and more. So he was looking for somebody. You know, well, in those days perhaps they thought they had some occult powers. So you can exchange your health with somebody else. So your old body, your illness and all this can be transferred to another person. And the other person's health can be transferred into you. So, you know, for a story, this is all right. So, let us follow the story. So, the king had a lot of desires. He wanted to continue enjoying his kingdom. He may be 99-year-old, was ready to go to other world. But the old man, born, keep quiet. So, what happened, you know, he was looking for somebody who will exchange his youth to him and will take over his illness, his old age, everything. And his sons and daughters, they all rejected outright. Finally, one of his youngest children, one of them, and yet quite a good number of them, came forward and volunteered to accept his old age, his old body. The story is actually, you know, the story behind the story. The story contains a great message, that's all. But because the king finally makes a great statement, that's what we are trying to drive home. So the king became a young man again, and again he lived, he ruled the kingdom. And after several years, he found this is not taking him anywhere. It's not going to come to an end. Then he said, Na jatu kama kaman ubabhogena shamyadi havisha krishna vatmaiva bhuya eva abhivardhade. Again the earlier one was from Manu, this is from Mahabharata. So, following Manu's statement, he says, you are not going to put out the fire of desire by pouring more desires into the fire. It's like pouring more and more ghee or oil into burning fire. So, because the more fuel you add, the more it starts burning. So, it becomes a much bigger fire. So, desire can never be put out, eliminated. But all desires can be sublimated. Desires cannot be exhausted out, because is like trying to stop the movement of water in river or in ocean. So what happens? All days can be given a spiritual orientation. And once we give a spiritual orientation, then what happens? The same action becomes a means to come out of this wheel of bondage. That's the idea. And Lord Krishna makes a statement in the Bhagavad Gita. He says, any person, any spiritual seeker who makes an effort to practice yoga by this surrender to God, surrendering his actions and the results to God, Lord Krishna makes, I shall look after his problems, his life, everything. Yoga kshemam vahami. Now, there are two great promises in the Gita, which one I quoted yesterday. One is, whatever little you do, even if you meditate once in life, if you try to think of higher spiritual ideas, not even meditation, a few times in life, and then you won't get a chance, still, that will produce a result. Now, every action produces an invisible potency. Whatever we do creates two types of results. One is visible, the other is invisible. So in Sanskrit, it is called apurva and adrishta. It is called apurva because before you do that action, that potency did not exist. So it is called apurva, means something that did not exist before your action. Adrishta means invisible. Now, suppose we undertake a journey, or we do something undesirable, or we do a noble deed, whatever, depending upon the context. There is a visible, obvious consequence that we can see and experience immediately as a part of the cause-effect link. The result, so the action is the cause, the result is the effect. We can see that. Then there is another invisible potency. What is that? A tendency is created in the mind. A vritti, what is called vritti or vasana. It acts as a memory. In its grossest manifestation, it is a memory. When memory comes back, that memory can influence our future action. The grossest and most simple, obvious consequence is that we recollect that action and its result. We cannot run away from it. If you have done any action with full consciousness, there is the one visible, obvious result, which is there for all of you to see and experience. The other one, an invisible, a totally unavoidable potency, and that remains with us. We cannot run away from it. It is already within our system. Vedanta says, if we have done something noble and good, that invisible result, which is called adrishta, because it is unseen or invisible, it will be there in our system. When we are born again, we will be able to continue our spiritual journey as a result of this. This is one promise. Nahi kalyana kaschid durgadin tadabhichin, this statement. The other one is yoga kshemam vahamya. What is it? Ananya chindayandomam yejana paryubasade tesham nitya abhiyuktanam yoga kshemam vahamya. This is a great promise. There are many other promises, but these are two most unforgettable promises, all of them. What does it mean? Those who do their work sincerely, thinking their mind that every action, every word, every deed, every thought is an offering to God, will have a focus in their mind, focus on God or speech, any spiritual idea, depending upon their spiritual tradition. Such a person's material and spiritual welfare will be the responsibility of God. That's the literal meaning. That is the great promise. So I shall read, it's a very interesting subject, I shall read some important, I can quote some important explanations of this statement. So you have to remember, the verse is ananya sindayantomam ye jana paryupas. Anyone, any person who practices this yoga, keeping in mind that everything belongs to God. So whatever we do, whatever we think, whatever we speak, becomes a God-oriented spiritual practice. It's called yajna. And Lord Krishna says, their welfare, and not only spiritual welfare, even their food, their clothing, everything will be my responsibility. That's what Lord Krishna says, the commentaries. So one commentator says, for example, you know, yogam ikaloke sevopayogartham dhana dhanya vastradi labham kshema. That is yoga. Yoga means what? Sevopayogartham dhana dhanya vastradi labham means your food, whatever money you need, your bank balance, or your clothing, or material empirical needs. Plus, kshemam cha amutra atyantikam seyu moksha lakshanam vahami. So not only your material needs, like food, clothing, but also your spiritual need, your spiritual liberation, your spiritual enlightenment, either in this life or after death, will be my responsibility. I shall take care of it. This is great promise. And in actual life, what happens is, when you offer all your actions to God, those actions they fit into a pattern. Naturally, you won't be doing anything that will be eventually harmful. See, once we offer something to somebody, and if we remember that, and if we offer to God, if we remember that, then we attach a sense of sanctity to whatever we do. See, we do puja, liturgy in the church, or offerings, hymns, or psalms, or anything. If we sing devotion song, you won't shout. At least, music may not be very pleasant to hear, but the singer will do that with great sense of sanctity, with the feeling of sacredness of what he's doing. Puja or meditation or any kind of such spiritual activity. So that takes care of the quality of actions and also character. Once we start considering all our actions and deeds as sacred deeds and actions, then you won't be doing anything in a negligent, indifferent manner. So naturally, God starts manifesting our life in the form of this sense of sanctity to whatever we do. So, your material need and spiritual attainment both become the responsibility of God. Matprapti അനുപരാവൃത്തിരൂപം ആമുഷ്മികം യോഗക്ഷേമം ശരീരയാത്രാധനാദി ലക്ഷണ എവറിഥിങ് യു നോ മീൻസ് ശരീരയാത്ര മീൻസ് ഹോൾ ലൈഫ് ഫോർ ദാറ്റ് ധനാദി ലക്ഷണം വസ്ത്രാദി ലക്ഷണം യു നീഡ് ക്ലോത്തിങ് യു നീഡ് മണി യു നീഡ് ഫുഡ് ഓൾ ദീസ് തിങ്സ് ദാറ്റ് വിൽ ബി ദ റെസ്പോൺസിബിലിറ്റി ഓഫ് ഗോഡ് ആൻഡ് ഓൾസോ യുവർ സ്പിരിച്വൽ പ്രോഗ്രസ് ഓൾസോ ബിക്കംസ് ദ റെസ്പോൺസിബിലിറ്റി ഓഫ് ഗോഡ്. And not only that, another commentator is Amrita Tarangini, a great Tigagara, is called Purushottama. He says, Yogam Sevartha Dhanadi Sambhatti Labham Sevade Madhyogam Vakshemam Tatpalanam Bhakti Mukhi Garanatmagam Madhavarupam Va Akam Purushottama Vahami Parayamityatha. So, there are a few commentators like Vandabha, Purushottama, and mostly devotional philosophy. They say, so bhakti mukhi garanatmagam, all actions, all deeds and words will become a spiritually oriented endeavor. Then you know what happens, whole life gets spiritualized. And I take responsibility for their welfare, not only material welfare, but also spiritual welfare. Now, another statement that Ishavasyamanishad makes includes a grim warning. So on the one hand, ഈശാവാസിമിതം സർവം യത്കിഞ്ച ജഗത്യാൻ ജഗത്തേന ത്യക്തേന മുഞ്ചീത ദിസ് ഇതേന ത്യക്തേന മുഞ്ചീത എൻജോയ് ത്രൂ ത്യാഗ ത്രൂ ഓഫറിംഗ് ടു ഗോഡ് ത്രൂ റിനൗൻസിയേഷൻ ത്രൂ ദി സ്പിരിച്വൽ എൻഡീവർ ദാറ്റ്സ് വൺ തിങ് സപ്പോസ് വി ഡോണ്ട് ഡു ദാറ്റ് വാട്ട് ഹാപ്പൻസ് സപ്പോസ് വി ഡിനൈ ദി എക്സിസ്റ്റൻസ് ഓഫ് എനിത്തിങ് ട്രാൻസെൻഡന്റ് Well, I am this body is the only thing that we have got. The five senses and the enjoyment that they bring to the mind are the only things that you should bother about, you should care for. So those who deny any higher transcendental spiritual value, the Upanishad calls such people self-destructive, and what they are doing is a kind of spiritual suicide, because you are denying your own entity. So that is why the Lord I'd say asurya nama te loka andhena tamasa vrutah tan te preti abhigacchanti ekecha atmahano jana. So this Upanishad, the same Ishavasya Upanishad, gives a green warning. This intellectual spiritual suicide, which is indicated by the word atmahan atmanam khanti, means killing oneself, means denying one's own atman, one's own spiritual identity. Okay, now what happens is they live and they are driven into a world of darkness. What happens to people driven by intellectual arrogance and perpetual skepticism? So remember, intellectual inquisitiveness is a positive virtue, which I said earlier, that would take you out of this veil of skepticism. Sincere inquiry, sincere quest for knowledge and information will take us beyond skepticism. It's like a straight line. It doesn't have a curve. So once you travel from the bottom to the top of the street line, then we are out of it. We leave behind skepticism, as happened to many great spiritual seekers who are also great intellectuals. Swami Vivekananda is one example we quoted. What about St. Augustine, for example? St. Augustine was a learned man. His mother was worried, so much worried about this educated, intelligent person. One day he heard some statement at the beginning of a new life. He was a sincere person, otherwise he would have closed his ears. I won't care for it. So, you know, if a person is sleeping, if you make a noise, if you keep the alarm on, he may wake up. Suppose he is pretending to be asleep. You give him a blow, he will struggle hard to keep his eyes closed, because he's not willing to wake up. The reason is he's not sleeping. So intellectual skepticism is like a cycle, wheel, that keeps us rotating along the way, never allowing to come out of it. But genuine intellectual inquisitiveness is a positive virtue. That's like a straight line, and not a wheel, not a cycle, but a straight line. So once you travel, once you move from the bottom to the top of the straight line, then you transcend, go beyond it. So the point is, those who deny without making any inquiry, without making any effort to understand, well, I am only this body, there is nothing more in this world to bother about, except the five senses and what we see and enjoy. The Upanishad says, they are driven, led to a world of darkness, spiritual darkness. And they are slayers of the self, meaning they are committing spiritual suicide. In the sense, they kill their own self. When they deny, they are killing it. They are pushing themselves into an abyss. So Shankaracharya uses a very strong language to drive home this idea. Avidya doshena vidyamanasya atmanah tiraskaranat atmahana iti uchyate. So why they are called Atmahana? The Upanishad uses the term. Asudhya namate loka andhena tamasavrataha tan te preti abhigichandi yekecha atmahano jana. Such people are slaves of their own Atman, their own inner self. Those who commit spiritual suicide. So Shankaracharya says, by denying their own spiritual identity, they are committing spiritual suicide. They are spiritually killing themselves. Therefore, they are called Atmahana. And they live in perpetual spiritual darkness. There is a way to come out of this darkness. We need not do much. See, the beginning of spiritual life, especially in the practice of karma yoga, you don't have to leave anything behind. You add to whatever you do the spiritual idea. That means this yoga idea should be added to karma idea. Karma becomes karma yoga. Action becomes spiritually charged, refined action. It's called karma yoga. Then we come out of this way. And then it takes us to spiritual life. The other one takes us to spiritual death. Denial of this identity of our Atman leads us to spiritual death. Affirmation and slow practice, gradual practice of this karma yoga takes us out of spiritual darkness. So now we'll have interaction for half an hour, so we can stop.
So there's one chapter in the Old Testament about Job. God, instead of taking care of all of Job's problems, takes away all of Job's joy and life. So how does Job fit into the Vedantic idea?
It shows God's grace to Job. Because his enjoyment, his lifestyle was taking him away from the path leading to God. That is another mechanism you find in spiritual life. I shall repeat the question related to Job. God took away all his happiness, everything. It happens. So there is a great statement in one of the Puranas that exactly fits with this. Yasya anugraha michami tasya vittam gharamiham bandhavaishta viyogena vrisham bhavadi dukhidaha tena dukhena samtatto idhi mamna parityaji tam prasadam karishyami ke devairavi sudurna. The context is this. God is making a big promise. What is the promise? He says, those whom I want to bless, what I do? Suppose one of God's devotees, a spiritual seeker. He's a sincere seeker. But somehow he is caught in a trap. He becomes enormously rich, a trillionaire, so to speak. And then he forgets his spiritual practices. He may turn into bohemian, his whole lifestyle may undergo change for the worse. That means to that extent, as I mentioned earlier, he will be moving to a spiritual darkness. If God has some grace for him, if he is a sincere seeker, then what God does? Tasya vittam haramekam. I shall take away all his wealth. I shall take all the wealth away from him. Here there are two moments happening. God takes his obstacle from his path and he removes He takes his devotee from a difficult terrain in which he may get lost. So very often, many of the problems that spiritual seekers have to confront should be interpreted as demonstrations on the part of God to help them. It frequently happens. Sometimes when we look back, people face tragedies and problems which make their spiritual life more intense. After some years, when they look back, suddenly they may realize, well, if that had not happened in my life would have been hell. So what appears to be a problem, like taking all the wealth away from Joe, for a moment he might have felt that way. But then he became great because of that unpleasant experience. And also the verse continues, says, Bandhavaisa Viyogena. Suppose you are very popular, lot of seeker fans, friends, some of them not desirable type people, may take you away from the path of spirituality. If God isn't graceful, then He will get you isolated. It means your undesirable friends, associations will fall off, drop off. And still, if the devotee, spiritual seeker, continues, persists in his spiritual pursuit, then I shall elevate him to such a position that even the angels will be jealous of him. That's a literal translation. Literal translation. So, frequently, this happens in the life of spiritual seekers. When it really happens, we may feel, oh, I pray so much, see, this is what is happening. But if you wait for some time and after some years or maybe even months, when we look back, we may feel, well, that is the beginning of a new chapter. So, very often in the spiral of spiritual life, you know, we travel for some distance and then we are still making progress. We don't feel the progress, as I said earlier, from 0 to 3, we feel the momentum of change and progress. From 3 to 9, we may not feel it so intensely, though we are progressing actually. So at that time, we may feel, oh, we are not making enough progress. It may appear that we are in a stagnant condition. At that time, some of these unpleasant experiences will be necessary shock treatments that will keep us on track. So, very often, you see, look at Swami Vivekananda. He was a very gifted person. If you read Swami Vivekananda's life from one perspective, it is so mind-boggling. Arguably, he was perhaps the most gifted student of his university. The most brilliant student. And so he was a skillful organizer. But then, you know, he could not even get a job. He was trying to get a small teacher's job, school teacher's job. You can just imagine. People who were far inferior to him would have found it very easy. So that is, you have to remember the later half of 19th century when there were not many graduates in the city. There were so many opportunities compared to the availability of well-educated youngsters like Vivekananda. Even M was a postgraduate and a very gifted, very, very skillful teacher. He also, for some time, failed to get a teacher's job in school. Don't mind that. I'm not considering that's a very low thing. But still think of it. A very learned person, a brilliant graduate of the university in the last 2-3 decades of 19th century, failing to get this little job with teacher. And then one day he was walking, he sat down at the Octoluni Mount. This is a one of the landmark of the city, Calcutta. And he was saying, if I had created, I would have created a better world than God. He makes a remark. He was so frustrated, apparently. Then, but Sri Ramakrishna, his guru, later said, Vivekananda had to go through this experience because that made him aware of certain aspects of his mission for which he came. his humanism, his love for the poor, and many other ideas related to social reform, educational reform, and his awareness of the of some of the stark realities of everyday life in this world, which he displays in his lectures, letters and writings. All this happened because he himself had to go through some of these trials and tribulations in his life. So Sister Nivedita, for example, makes an analysis of his personality and the nature of his teachings and his prophetic mission. So, a complete awareness of some of the grim realities, stark, unpleasant realities of life in this world, like poverty, backwardness, helplessness, all these, you know, which you find in Vivekananda's writings, coming up again and again, when he talks about, when he expounds some highly humanistic ideas. This would not happen if you had not gone through this. So, Sri Ramakrishna himself makes this. Mother, Divine Mother, the universe made him go through all these experiences. Sri Ramakrishna is a statement. So, you can see that.
Swami, could I say something about Job?
Please.
You mentioned that little boy who was so determined.
Yeah.
Great determination.
Yeah.
And I think that Job is often seen as a superlative example of spiritual determination. Everything material is taken away. His health, his family, his herds, everything. And yet his faith in God never wavered. His faith in God's love for human care. And I think the test was that God knew that Job was a perfect man, and then there was this sort of evil force that said, well, we're going to show that he's not a perfect man. And the whole book shows that he is perfect because he will not cease trusting in God and knowing that there's an answer. And then he has these three friends, so-called friends, who tell him, you should accept the fact that you're a sinner and that all these problems have come on you because you have sinned. And that's the ancient, very old Jewish teaching, that if you have a problem, you've done something wrong. And he said, no, that's not true. He was being tested, as you said. And so he doesn't give up. And then at the end, he has this vision of the Absolute, which is like in the Gita, you know, when God appears. And
full effulgence.
Job can't speak.
Yeah.
And you know, he says, I know that thou canst do everything, and that nothing can be withholden from thee. And it's beautiful. The last two chapters are very much like the Gita. You know, because God shows him the whole universe all under his control and power and love.
Excellent.
I mean, it's you know, he's sort of like a yogi.
Yeah, yeah.
You know?
Job's determination. You know, this verse which I quoted. Tena dukkena santapto yadi mam na parityaji tam prasadam karishyami yad devairabhi sudhurlavo. You know what it literally means? Here God is making a promise. In spite of all day's tragedies and problems, still, if he is not affected by that, if he doesn't desert me, if he still clings fast to me, then I shall elevate him to such a position that even the angels will be jealous of him.
And then in the end,
it is so closely fits in with this idea
and then
of
in the end,
complete
Job,
surrender and complete faith.
And then in the end, Job gets everything back and more.
Yeah.
You know, not that he's looking for more, but all of this comes to him because of his faithfulness.
Yes, yes, yes.
He's just, you know, I think there is some evidence there, you know, was never a real Job, but the story is so profound.
Yeah, you know, it's very,
it's
a very strong message.
The beginning and the end are really important to understanding what's going on in the story of Job, because it opens in the divine assembly. The Most High is there with all of these other gods. Satan comes in, and the Most High brags. He says, look at my perfect devotee, Job. And Satan says, he's not perfect. He only seems perfect because you favor him. If you take that away, then we'll see if he's perfect or not. And so there's a wager. There's gambling going on. And Most Pike says, fine, test him. Do whatever you want. Just don't kill him. And then Satan goes, messes with his health, and of course Job is totally perfect through all of that, not complaining, telling the people who are telling him that he sinned, that it's his fault. No. And then in the end, when Job finally is able to meet with the Most High, he asks him, why did you do this? And the Most High says, don't you mind that? Were you around when I created the earth and laid the foundations of creation? Here, take everything that I gave that you lost, and here's some more too. Just be quiet. Yeah.
this seems precisely the story of King Harishchandra.
Yeah, very similar story. You find it is striking. The Bhagavatam, Mahabharata, the Bible, Old Testament. You find many grand illustrations from different cultures. If you look beyond the minor differences in analogies or imageries or examples of language, you find the ideal is almost identical.
The same.
Yes.
And then he was all alone. I mean, he didn't even have a sense of God being with him. He was just this great spiritual seeker, and had no one to support him and help him, except God was there, but he couldn't feel him.
So we see sublimation of desire, is that only through surrender?
Yes, sublimation of desire is the first step to surrender. Because when all our emotions and feelings and actions are all given spiritual orientation, that gradually takes us to the surrender idea. That's the idea. That's the first step, the gate. Because you don't lose anything, you don't leave anything behind. Whatever you do, give it a different orientation. So, of course, the scriptures give 9 methods of practicing this, Sravanam, Girtanam, Vishnu, Smaranam, Badasevanam, Marchanam, Vandanam, Dasim, Sakhyam, Atmanivedanam. What you hear many things. Hear some, picking with some good things also going on. So you sing many things, you sing about God, and you remember about spiritual ideas. You perform many rituals, perform them with spiritual orientation. Like that, all possible physical, mental, verbal activities are given a new direction. Now that doesn't take much effort, apparently. So starting Karma Yoga on one fine morning is a tall order. And the mind goes blank. That's what the Tikagara, some of the minor commentators have said. And in commenting on this verse, Lord Krishna says, don't tell one person, don't instruct one person to practice non-attachment on one fine morning. You'll be upsetting the whole pattern of our mental life, our mode of activity. So, give a spiritual orientation.
Shamji,
Job
asked connecting with God.
Yoga,
in different ways. So in Ishapurvishar, looks like the stress has been given more on karma yoga. Or is it possible to get the highest without achieving the jnana yoga?
Yes, in the Ishapurvishar, I quoted only the first two verses while expounding karma yoga. Even in the first verse itself, the first line is an exposition of the highest jnana, highest knowledge, highest philosophy. The entire world, whole creation is pervaded by the divine.
Yeah.
It's a great statement. So that's the premise, the first step. So why should you give up your desire? Why should you sublimate the desire? Why can't you go ahead? There's an answer, there's an explanation, there's a reason for it. Because this world is not there for you to enjoy and exploit. And so it should be seen to be pervaded by the divine. Does it mean that you run away from it? No. Continue living in the same world, doing your actions, but it should be done from a different perspective. So how do you do that? Link your action with the renunciation idea. So, tena tyektena, means tyekta means tyaga kiya. So, whatever you do, you link it to the renunciation idea. Why? Because the whole creation is pervaded by the divine. So, you should remember the first line of the first mantra itself is a grand statement of the highest jnana idea in the Visavasyamas. To be understood clearly. I didn't deal with the other subsequent verses, only first one or two verses.
Swami, I was thinking that story you told about the devotee who looked at the photograph. I was thinking the link between all the stories of Dhruva, and then we talked about Job, that they all didn't forget God.
Yeah.
And that was just, that's so safe when you... And we have this expression, I don't know if you have it in Hindu or another language, you know, where you tie a string around your finger.
Yeah.
And I read an experience of a woman who had this terrible problem, and so she tied a string around her finger so she would think of God.
Ooh,
instead
yeah.
of the problem.
Yeah, yeah.
Just thought that was interesting.
And the problem was resolved.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah,
that's
yeah.
right.
Because it makes that person remember
yes.
The link between the tying the string and God idea.
Yes.
So sometimes some spiritual seekers, when they make pilgrimages, they take a vow to give up something, giving up something
mm-hmm.
as part of it.
Like Lent.
And yes, a vow. No. Yes. That reminds you of a higher motive to your life.
Yes.
So that in a way creates a link
mm-hmm.
to a higher idea.
Yes.
And then Swami, isn't there a phrase in this Upanishad, remember to remember? I think it says on the first...
Oh yes, that Kridamsara. That's the... Yeah, you know, for the last 15, 16, 17, all these verses, when a devotee... who has led a pure life, an ideal life, praying to God and dedicating his activities to God. So he's asking God to help him to remember. In a way, he's asking his own mind.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Mind, turn back and remember all the good deeds you have done. Kridam smara, kridam smara. Please remember.
Mm-hmm.
Remember all the good things you have done.
Mm-hmm.
So in a way, you know... if the mind doesn't think of higher thoughts at the last moment, then the next life may not be very pleasant. If you can think of higher ideas, higher deeds you have done in this life, then you'll be able to continue the journey from where you have left it in this life. So that's one of the reasons why when a person is dying, people chant scriptures, hymns, psalms, devotional things, so that the dying person may listen to this, and that may make him remember higher ideas. So that's why in the traditional Hindu community, the greatest service you can do to a person is to help him remember God at the last moment. So I shall I shall illustrate this idea in the light of another very, very striking illustration from the importance of what we do in our life and the importance of remembering the good deeds that we have done and how it connects to our next life. So that helps us to look at death itself as a very natural, spontaneous transition point.
Mm-hmm.
There is nothing scary about it. So, Because you, as I said yesterday, you know, you are from here, you are going to Chicago, you have to change the plane. Right. You don't cry and weep because you have to change your plane. It doesn't involve anything special about it. So like that. So I think we have completed. So we'll continue discussion tomorrow. Om Shanti 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 Hari Om Tatsa Sri Ramakrishna Paramahamsa. Thank you.